In November of 2011, Sherry Winter flew to Athens and boarded the RV Atlantis for what was to be her first research cruise. But what was intended to be a research mission quickly turned into a rescue mission. The crew of the Atlantis responded to a Mayday call and pulled 93 Egyptian men from a foundering fishing boat. Sherry is a science writer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She was on board the Atlantis to blog about the research taking place. She joins me today to tell the story of what happens when a research cruise goes awry. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning.
Sherry, you've been working at HUI since 2009, but this was your first time going to sea. Why now? Is there something special about this particular cruise, or was it just time to get your feet wet?
Pretty much time to get my feet wet. As soon as I arrived at HUI, my boss, Lonnie Lipset, said that he wanted every writer at HUI to have some experience on a research cruise, just to find out what the scientists have to go through to get their information. It's really just incredible amount of work. So we had been looking at cruises ever since I had arrived. This one was about the right length. It was only 2 weeks. Lonnie had been on one that was 7 weeks in the Arctic. He promised, no, he wouldn't make me do that. So it was about 2 weeks. The cruise was for a Dive and Discover. My job was for a Dive and Discover blog, and that's a program that HUI has to reach out to school kids primarily. And Dive and Discover had never gone to the Mediterranean before, so it was a good chance to sort of expand the program in that respect. Dive and Discover had also never highlighted the remotely operated vehicle Jason, which would be used on this cruise. So there were a lot of reasons for us to go there, and it was just my time, I guess.
So, as you said, this was a cruise going out in the Mediterranean. You took off from Athens. I know a lot of the work of doing a cruise, going on a cruise, actually takes place beforehand, because as you said, you're only out there for 2 weeks, and it can sometimes take months to actually get ready. What was your preparation like? Right. You didn't necessarily have to get instruments and sample bottles or anything like that ready, but what did you do to prepare and get yourself actually to the boat?
Right. Actually, there was a lot of writing that had to be done ahead of time, partly because we had never gone to the Mediterranean before for Dive and Discover, so we like to provide research materials, background material for teachers and students on the Dive and Discover website. So I wrote about the Mediterranean. The science was going to be exploring some heavy brine lakes at the very bottom of the Mediterranean, and these had never been written about before on Dive and Discover. So we had a lot of background to write there just so that the people reading the blog would have some idea of why we were going there. All that had to be done ahead of time. I had to get up to speed on the science that would be done so that during the cruise, I didn't have to ask really basic questions of the scientists because they're very busy. And I thought, well, if this is something that I could figure out myself or ask them before the cruise, then that's going to save time during the cruise. So I actually spent the better part of 3 months or a little more before the cruise preparing those materials, video interviews with the chief scientists, things like that.
So then you get to Athens, you fly over to Athens, you get on board the boat, you think you're all ready to go out for this two-week cruise, takes off and what, for about 10 hours or so, it seems like it's pretty normal. What are you guys doing on that first day as you're heading out into the Mediterranean?
We get safety training. Everybody gets to put on what's called a Gumby suit because it makes you look like the Gumby character. And what those are is if we had to abandon ship, you zip yourself into one of these suits and it completely encloses you except for a little bit of your face that shows, and it will keep you afloat and warm. So it's insulated, it's rubberized, and so if you have to bail out, you can just bob there on the surface, and it's bright red so that the rescuers can find you. But they're hard to get into, especially after you get your first hand in and you have to zip up everything else with your one remaining hand. We did that. We did fire drill, just sort of learned our way around the boat. And for a lot of people who had done this before, it was old hat, but everybody still has to attend. For people like me, everything was new. That was also probably the roughest weather we had, and being our first day on the ship, I was really sick for much of the day, so that was no
miserable.
Fun at all. But just sort of settling in, the scientists were assembling their instruments, getting ready for their first deployment.
When did you know or start to get the sense that something was not going the way it was supposed to, that something was going wrong?
Well, you're asking about a specific event, but I want to say already things had gone a little bit awry because we had lost a key member of the science party that morning. Peter Fisher from the University of Connecticut woke up that morning with kidney stone.
Oh, wow.
It was huge. All the work that he had planned to do either had to be not done or collect samples and have him deal with them later, or somebody else do some of it. He also was scheduled to take a major rotation on some of these long nighttime deployments of the Jason vehicle. And so without him in the rotation, everybody else had to work that much longer hours. So the day had already started with us losing a valuable member of the team, not to mention that Peter was in excruciating pain and was having trouble getting back home. The scientists were adjusting their schedule to take that into account. Then we get to the evening event, which I think is probably what you're asking about.
Yeah, so you've already been scrambling all day, obviously.
Right.
You get to the evening and started to get a little tense on the boat, weren't quite sure what was happening. You ran into somebody in the hallway who said,
"Well, things
something's going on. We need to gather and meet."
I didn't notice any tension. I was going back for more dessert. This was late at night. My stomach had settled. I hadn't been able to have much dinner, but then it settled, and there was a wonderful pumpkin cheesecake pie, which was great. So I had gone back
obviously
for seconds.
Made an impression.
It obviously did. I've been thinking about it ever since. And I took my slice of pie and was headed downstairs to the lab, and I met our chief scientist, Ginny Edgecombe, in the hall, and she was tense, and she said, "Round up everybody you can and bring them to the main lab because we have a situation." Okay. So what does that mean? So we all gathered in the main lab. This was the science party. Now, the crew were mostly out someplace else, although we were with one of the ship's technicians, Katie Graver, and she had a walkie-talkie, so she was in communication with the bridge. And the situation was that the Atlantis had received a mayday call from an Egyptian fishing vessel that was taking on water. We had been asked by, I think, the Greek Coast Guard, and there's sort of an international organization, maritime organization, because right. The Mediterranean has so many countries around there. They were trying to figure out how to save these people on the boat, and they, for some time, we didn't know. I think it was maybe half an hour. We were waiting for word, which finally came that it had been decided that the Atlantis would be the ship to save these people.
And I mean, by the law of the sea, if you're asked for help, you don't get a choice. You don't get to refuse. You have to
right.
go provide whatever help you can
right.
provide.
Right, sure. And of course, you're happy to do it. If these people are in danger, you don't want to just steam off into the night and say, "Well, good luck." You know, you want to help them. The scary part for us was that first reports were that it was 150 people.
Wow. I mean, you guys only had 50 people aboard the Atlantis in total.
Right. Our whole, ship's crew, Jason crew, science party was 50 people. And here we're supposed to bring on 150 men. And where do we put them? What do we do with them? And you hear tales of piracy. Before I left, my mom, who had come out from Colorado with my dad to take care of my house and my pets, had her checklist, and she worries about things. So she had her checklist, and one of the things she said was, "Okay, now what if you get taken by pirates?" And I said, "No, Mom, that's never going to happen, So here this thing happens, and of course that flashes into my mind. Because we didn't see anything scary, but there was a lot of uncertainty. We didn't really know what we were dealing with.
Well, so you head over to help with this boat, but because you don't know what you're dealing with, right, they put the whole ship into lockdown. Only the crew of the
right.
ship, which we should, explain, there's the crew of the ship that kind of stays with the Atlantis, and then there's the scientists who come on board and
right.
switch out every few weeks for whatever the science is being done.
Right.
So the science party had to go into lockdown, right?
Well, yes. Now, the lockdown was dictated by Coast Guard regulations for maritime security. So they raised it, I think normal cruising level is MARSEC 1, and they raised it just 1 to MARSEC 2. So it was slightly more secure, but these are measures that are, there's a standard list. If you go to MARSEC 2, here are the steps that you have to do. And one of those was that non-ship's crew people stay behind lock doors and stay out of sight. And you cover the windows. Basically, it means there are strangers coming on board. They're just strangers, right. Not necessarily hostile. We just don't know who they are. So we don't want them to see the inner parts of the ship or the people who aren't ship's crew. So that's where that was. So yes, we were shuttered in. We were essentially blind.
I mean, where were you shut in? How big a space was this?
It's pretty big space. The main lab is, oh gosh, I don't know, 50 feet long and 30 feet wide or 20 feet wide, something like that. It's big. And then right across the hall, there's a much smaller computer lab. So we could go between those two. And at least we were all together. So that was good. But we couldn't see out, and we kept waiting for these little snatches of information coming over the walkie-talkie.
You guys had some closed-circuit TV, though, so you could see a little bit, right? I mean, you couldn't actually stick your head out a window and see firsthand. But
right. So once we got next to the fishing boat, the ship, the Atlantis, does have some security cameras mounted at various points around the ship, just to sort of closed-circuit TV like a security camera at a mall. And so in the computer lab, we had these two small screens. They were maybe 6 inches square, and it's that kind of greenish speckled color. It wasn't a good image at all.
I mean, there's a slideshow on the HUI website, right. And I've seen some of those pictures, and they're pretty grainy. You're not getting a lot of information.
Right. And that was it. That was our window on what was going on. So we see, you know, we could see this little boat, and it was just jammed with people. It was just crowded. The boat had been a fishing vessel, but it was not fishing at the time. It was bringing people who were trying to get to Italy, they said. They were trying to cross the Mediterranean from Egypt to Italy.
I mean, this is kind of like, you know, here in the U.S. hearing about people trying to get from Cuba to Florida,
right.
On these tiny boats that
right.
just aren't
exactly
capable of making the crossing. And you wrote that when it actually pulled up alongside, some of the crew tried to actually tie the two boats together, and cleats were coming off in their hands. The boat was basically just rotten wood that was falling apart.
Right. Now, we couldn't see that. Some of the crew told me that the next day. But that told them right away that, yes, this ship really is in trouble. This boat is in trouble because, there were pieces rotting off it. And the weather had come up. It was near gale force winds. And the Atlantis was rolling a bit, but it's a good-sized ship. But this boat, even with all those people on it, it was just pitching up and down. I mean, I almost got sick again just watching it on the closed-circuit TV. It was pitching so much. So they were in trouble.
And so they start bringing people over one by one.
Right.
And you're watching this on the closed-circuit TV from inside, and I take it you were kind of gauging how to react to this situation based on how one particular crew member out on deck was reacting.
Right. And it was the Jason expedition leader. So he was Tito Colossius, and he was the head of the Jason team for that cruise. So he's not part of the ship's crew, but Tito's very tall, and he had on a distinctive colored jacket, and he always wore cargo shorts with these white footy socks. And so that's about all the detail I could see on the closed circuit TV. I saw those socks. I said, oh, that's Tito, you know?
So you picked him because you could visually pick him out, or was there something about his personality that you knew you could kind of trust his judgment?
Mostly because he's the one I could recognize, because the Egyptians were in street clothes. I mean, you couldn't tell from their dress that wasn't a crew member necessarily. We couldn't see facial details, but Tito really stood out because of his socks and his jacket. And once I had him, okay. So, and he was right there at the front of the line, sort of examining everybody, taking a good close look at them as they came over. And the Atlantis people were bringing the Egyptians over one at a time to count them, get names, just to make sure how many we brought on so that we didn't end up with a stowaway later. They wanted to be sure that everyone who came on got off again.
Well, I mean, did anyone in all of these interactions, does anyone on board the Atlantis speak Arabic?
No.
Or did any of these Egyptians speak English? I mean, you've got a language barrier going on here.
Absolutely. And one of the Egyptians spoke some English, and he did go up to the bridge. He was taken up to the bridge to talk with Captain Colburn. And then two of the oil tankers nearby had each had somebody who spoke some Arabic. So on sort of a conference call with a variety of different people, they managed to communicate what was going on. So it was, yeah, I'm sure it was a very interesting evening for Captain Colburn trying to figure that out.
But I'm sure that's an understatement,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
So you finally get these. It turned out to be 93, not 150, but that's still
a lot of people.
Twice the people that you had on board.
Right.
Where did you put all these guys and what did they do with them?
Well, because of the security level, they weren't allowed into the interior of the ship. But, you know, the Atlantis is the mothership of the submersible Alvin. But Alvin was not with us on this cruise, which meant that Alvin's hangar was empty. So
yes, that was lucky.
It was great because the weather was so foul outside that it would have been just horrible if these men had had to stay out on the open deck. They were able to go in the hangar, so it was covered. It was good from a safety, from our safety perspective, because they were confined. I mean, we knew where everybody was. Pretty small space for 93, but since it was cold out, that might not have been a bad thing to keep the temperature up. The Atlantis crew members the next day said that these men had been on their boat for 4 days. They hadn't eaten for 2 days.
Wow.
They had water up to mid-calf, you know, from standing in water in the boat. The first thing they went for was a drink of fresh water. Then they were escorted to the bathroom. And
there's only, that was kind of a process for 93 guys to take turns with one bathroom.
Right. It took a while, but they were polite. They were grateful. They were very relieved. You asked earlier about Tito, and what I saw with Tito was, you know, the first 15 or 20 minutes, he was very alert and leaning forward and looking everybody over very carefully. And then his body language completely relaxed, and he was standing back a bit. He was still looking at people, but his hands were in his pockets. He, as I interpreted it, he was not worried about these people. He saw nothing scary in them. And he found me the next day or 2 days later after reading what I said, that I said that in the blog, and he said, that's exactly right. That was exactly what happened. So our guests were very good guests. They were very, very hungry.
Well, and figuring out food to feed them must have been a bit of a challenge. I take it the first idea didn't turn out so well. The steward brought down bread and spam, and then you realized, of course, well, these men are Muslim. Spam isn't going to work, so...
Right. So
what did you feed them?
So then we got peanut butter, and they loved the peanut butter sandwiches. You know, if you've got 93 people, very, very hungry people in a small area, you want something that's easy. You're not going to take the time to cook. So, and if you're really hungry, peanut butter and jelly tastes great. That worked very well.
So, I mean, it was a long night for the crew out on deck. How about you guys? Did you get to go back to your cabins and sleep, or did you have to stay there in the lab the entire night?
No, we were able to go to our cabins. I slept a little bit. I did not. I stayed in my day clothes, and I kept my shoes on because, you know, we had just gone through the safety drill. And it said, you know, if you get up in the middle of the night and there's a fire drill, don't stop to dress. Don't stop to get your shoes. Just go. And I thought, well, if, you know, here's a situation where we might get mustered out, and I don't want to go out in my jammies, you know. I want my shoes. So I slept in full day clothes. So we got some sleep, probably more sleep than the Egyptians, and definitely more than our crew who did spend the whole night outside. There were a few of the men who needed some first aid, feeding, more bathroom trips, that sort of thing. The Atlantis crew was up all night.
So getting these guys on board the Atlantis was obviously the first step. Now they're on a safe ship, but where did you then take them?
We were actually pretty lucky. We were instructed to take them to Kalamata, the home of the olives, which was better than going all the way back to Athens, which would have been a full day steam. This, we got to Kalamata in about 8 hours, so we reached it in the morning, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. And then it took about an hour and a half to get everybody off one at a time. And the Greeks had set up a little processing station, getting names and finding out situations. And I think there was a Red Cross shelter set up. And at that point, then they were no longer our responsibility.
But you've already now been delayed by
a day.
A good day.
Yeah.
Right. And now you've got another day of steaming back out to where you'd started from before this happened, that's 2 days out of a 2 week cruise, or a day and a half out of a 2 week cruise. Were the scientists uptight about this? Were they distraught about the delay in the cruise?
Well, what Lonnie told me before I left, and everybody else who's been on a cruise has told me since then, is that stuff goes wrong on every cruise. You plan and plan and plan, and then you go to sea knowing that you're not going to be able to stick to your plan. A piece of equipment will break, or there will be weather that prevents you from putting your instrument in the water, or somebody gets sick, or you have to rescue 93 people or something. So I think they were a little concerned that it happened the first day. We had already lost Peter. Then this happened. So we hadn't, it's like you start thinking, okay, what else is going to go wrong? Because we haven't done any science yet. But this was a really cool thing. We saved 93 people. They would not have made it through the night. So that was a good thing. I know that Ginny and Joan Bernhard and the other scientists got together during the night and looked at their schedule and revised some things to say, okay, what are we going to have to give up? What should we start with tomorrow? So they adjusted, and we only lost, since we had come quite a ways from Athens, it only took us about another, I'm not sure, I think about another 8 hours to get to our first sampling station. So we lost about a half a day, three quarters of a day, something like that. So it wasn't too bad.
Well, and I guess, you know, we think about it in work days. If you lost 8 hours, you lost a work day. But of course,
right,
that's not what happens on a ship. On a research cruise, you're going 24 hours a day.
Right.
So,
right. It did affect the schedule. But
well, and did the crew that had been out there all night get any chance to rest before launching into science mode?
Some of them didn't. Because I know the bosun, Patrick Hennessy, that afternoon was out wrangling instruments, and a couple of the seamen were too. Ronnie Wims for one, and they were totally drained, but they really didn't have a chance to rest much. They had to catch up the next night. Yeah,
well, they had not only given their energy and their time. I take it some of these guys had actually given their clothes and their boots to the Egyptians who needed them, but they were. They were rewarded by the captain.
They were for their
efforts and their generosity.
Yes, the captain. Three of the crew members had given up their shoes, and so the captain gave each of them the credit to get a new pair of steel-toed work boots. So that was good. Yeah, a lot of the crew donated clothes. All of us gave our cotton blankets. We all had a cotton blanket and a wool blanket on our bed, and we all of those blankets from the ship went to the men. So, yeah, the crew really came through. And it was, you started out talking about how remarkable this was as my first cruise, but none of the crew members that I talked to had ever experienced anything like that either, even in all their years at sea. So it was remarkable.
I think one of the things that's most remarkable is that after this incredible start, everybody did get down to business, and it was a successful science cruise for the rest of the 2 weeks. And by the end of the 2 weeks, you're writing in your blog about kind of some of the silliness almost that's taking place as you're steaming back to the port at the end of the cruise and doing, a pseudo-scientific experiment, trying to figure out who walks the most on a research vessel.
Yeah, it struck me that, you know, a ship it's kind of claustrophobic in a way. I mean, you have the open horizon, but you can't actually go anywhere. You just walk around in circles. So, and I was trying to walk a lot just to do something other than sit. I'm a big walker at home, and it's not comfortable to not walk if you're used to walking. And the more I watched people, especially Patrick Hennessy, the bosun, and Ginny Edgecombe, our chief scientist, I thought, man, they're on the go all the time. So I had a little pedometer and passed it around and had a few people wear the pedometer for a day, and we had a little competition on who walked the most.
Who did walk the most?
And it was Patrick. Which was not really a surprise. And he walked, I think, over 3 miles, which is a long way on a 174-foot ship.
That's a lot of times walking in
a
circle.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, Sherry, after that start to introduction to research cruises, are you planning on going out again?
Well, right after I came back, I said I was in no hurry to go back. The cruise went great, but I'm not a natural sailor Our weather was pretty good, but my stomach didn't entirely settle down. It's kind of a pressure cooker situation. We had a great staff, great science staff. Everything went well. And so I'm thinking, okay, if I didn't really love it, even though everything went well, then I'm going to be really careful about where I go next time. But there have, you know, I hear about good cruises that are coming up, and I think, oh, that would be an interesting one to go on, because it really is special to see the people at work and be part of that team, and it's unlike anything I've ever done.
Well, you certainly have stories to tell, even if you never go back out.
Absolutely.
Sherry Winter is a science writer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She blogged the Dive and Discover Mission 14 and the rescue of 93 Egyptian men in the Mediterranean last November. Sherry, thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
You can find a link to Sherry's blog from Dive and Discover Mission 14 on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.